I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Leonard Bernstein would have turned 100 years old in August this year. And while the celebrated conductor, composer, educator, writer died in 1990 in his 70s, his work has lived on, including his musicals West Side Story and On the Town, the film score to On the Waterfront, as well as his ballets, symphonies, even his popular TV shows. Here's the overture to Candide, Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, recorded on September 28, 1960. While Leonard Bernstein's work and public persona are well known, we are less familiar with the man himself. Our guest, Jamie Bernstein, provides an intimate portrait of her dad and their family in her new memoir, Famous Father Girl. She's a writer, a concert narrator, and filmmaker, and was a guest on Radio Times a few years back on a film about a music program in Philadelphia called Play on Philly. Jamie Bernstein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back.
Famous Father Girl. Where did that title come from?
I know. I kind of love this title because it's a little bit like a poke in the eye. Actually, that is what my second grade classmate, Lisa, used to call me to tease me. Famous Father Girl. And so I decided to use that for my title.
To own it yourself.
Yes.
Is it easier to be your father's daughter as a grown-up than as a child or a teenager?
Well, some things are definitely easier now. The book is really about the whole experience of growing up with this blinding light for a dad, and to figure out how to make one's own light in, you know, when you're living in that overlit, sunlit environment. And it took a long time to sort it out, but it was there was also a lot of fun to be had along the way.
Well, I want to talk about all of that, but let me have you read a section, just a paragraph from your new book, your memoir.
Okay. It goes like this.
Okay.
In my mind's eye, my father is always in a scruffy brown wool bathrobe. My cheek still prickles at the memory of his scratchy morning hugs. He was frequently away on conducting tours, often for weeks at a time. We never felt we got enough of him. When he'd suddenly rematerialize at the front door, putting down his soft leather suitcase and squatting down to enfold us in his arms, Alexander, my brother, and I would tumble all over him like puppies, daddy, 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 mad with joy and hungry for the presents he'd brought us from those faraway lands. Mummy stood to the side, grinning, waiting her turn for the deep, tender kiss her husband would give her.
I love that paragraph, and we return to it really at the end of the book as well. There are many adjectives you use to describe your dad. One of them was exhausting. How would you describe how you saw your father growing up?
Well, you know, he was truly larger than life in every possible way. He wasn't just a musical genius, but he was also, as my mother used to say, a man with a motor. He was just going on all 16 cylinders all the time. He was a terrible insomniac. He literally could not shut off his motor. So he was up all night, and he just had all this energy. The rest of the world could hardly keep up with him.
Well, it seemed that he was a voracious person. I mean, voracious for life, voracious for music, for people.
Yes, he loved people, and he loved being surrounded by people. So that meant that he loved having the whole family together and all the friends, and he loved nothing more than to sit at the piano and have everybody all huddled around him, everybody, you know, screaming, bawling out songs at the top of their lungs. That was his idea of fun.
And a lot of competition, too, right? Word games and...
Yes, he was very competitive with his kids just as much as with his friends and the rest of the family. You know, we played lots of word games and we played, you know, water volleyball and we played tennis. And so there was a lot of competitive spirit, but it was all with very good humor, really.
I thought it was interesting in that paragraph you read that you write, "We never felt we got enough of him." Is that because he wasn't there so much of the time?
It wasn't just that he was away a lot, which he was. When he came home, he was really around, and he lavished attention on us three kids. So when we had him at home, we felt like we got plenty of him. But we had to share him with not only all the other people in his life, but the whole rest of the world. So there was that sense of it being very precious to have him just at home with us.
Did you resent that, having to share him with the rest of the world, including myself?
Well, I guess we would have resented it more had it not been for the fact that when he was with us, he was really with us. And he clearly enjoyed having us around. And I don't think we ever felt unwelcome in his presence. We were always allowed to interrupt him when he was working in his studio. We tried not to do that, but we often sort of barged in and asked him questions or had to show him something or would play with his little gadgets or anything like that. We never felt unwelcome. And he often invited us along when he was working. So if he had rehearsals, he would ask us to come along, or he invited us to go on the road with him when he toured, say, with the New York Philharmonic. And that was a ton of fun.
You and your dad shared a love of the Beatles, of John Lennon. How did he express, I guess, his passion for this kind of music?
Well, it was really my lucky break that my dad was a person who loved all kinds of music. He was not interested in putting up barriers between genres or making a value judgment about one kind of music over another. And so when the Beatles came on the scene, he loved their music, and I was a complete Beatle maniac. They were everything to me. So it was my lucky break that every time a new Beatles album came out, I would run to the store and buy it and dash straight to my dad's studio and say, "Look, look, Daddy, I got it. And we would slap it right on the turntable and sit down on the couch together with the album cover in our laps and listen to the music and marvel over it. And then I would learn so much about music just by having my dad comment on the music as it went along.
It's such a fascinating story because I think for a lot of kids growing up, their parents don't like their music and they don't appreciate it and they don't hear the things that your dad heard in the Beatles.
That's right. And in fact, my father eventually started using not just the Beatles but other pop artists on his young people's concerts to illustrate whatever topic he was discussing. So, for example, when he was talking about sonata form, he went to the piano and played the Beatles song "And I Love Her" and sang it too in his terrible scratchy voice to demonstrate the ABA form that corresponded to sonata form. And the adorable audience reactions were all caught on TV. You could see all the girls squirming in their seats because, oh my God, Bernstein is singing the Beatles. But, you know, I think it was also a very significant message to the parents who were watching as well, that he, the maestro of the New York Philharmonic, was not making a value judgment about popular music and, you know, was really welcoming it into his world of music. And that was a good message to convey to parents because it was not too many years after the time when, you know, parents were burning Elvis Presley records in the South.
Because of the way he moved his hips, right?
That's right.
He took you to meet the Beatles. But did you ever feel, especially with his exuberant personality, that his passion was greater than yours, or somehow, not that he stole this from you, but that you had to share it with him?
Well, I think it's always complicated when you're a kid or a pre-adolescent, especially, and the thing that you latch onto becomes something that your parents latch onto. It's complicated.
It is.
Yeah. And I had to balance that as I went along. But the overall experience – of sharing the Beatles with my dad was so positive that it was worth the, you know, small level of discomfort.
And were your friends entirely jealous when they learned that you had actually met the Beatles?
Oh, you can't imagine the pandemonium at my day camp the next day after I had just met the Beatles backstage at the Ed Sullivan Show rehearsal. This was when they came back to do their second appearance at the Ed Sullivan Show in the summer of 65. Mm-hmm. And this was when we all got to, my brother and I and my dad got to meet the Beatles in their dressing room at the Ed Sullivan Theater. And really, I mean, meeting God could not have been more exciting for me.
You mentioned the fact that your father was an insomniac. Is that when he wrote? Did he write at night when everyone else was asleep?
He did. Those were his best composing hours. I mean, during the day, he was so totally preoccupied with everything else he was doing in life. And conducting with orchestras is a very outward directed activity, which involves being surrounded by people. But composing is a very solitary task. And it was hard for him all his life to switch from one persona to the other. It was like he was two people in one body. He was the outward directed, totally surrounded by people person, and he loved being that person. But he was also a composer, and composing has to be done all by yourself.
Yeah.
And it was hard for him, but he felt compelled to do that. So 4 a.m. was kind of the ideal moment for that part of him.
Was it harder for him to compose than conduct?
I think it was harder for him to compose than conduct, yes, because he hated being alone. He hated being alone, but he felt compelled to compose. So it wasn't until 4 or 5 in the morning that he would finally, you know, be able to subside. The world around him would subside, and he could finally focus on that inner world of his.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. We are talking today on Radio Times with Jamie Bernstein, and we are talking about her life with her father. She does have a new memoir that she has just written called Famous Father Girl. And we're also playing music composed by her father. This is the prologue of Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story. He's conducting the New York Philharmonic again, 1960 Symphonic Dances. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, to join the conversation. And also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. Music and conversation after this very short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jamie Bernstein, and she is a writer, she's a concert narrator, she's a filmmaker, also author of a brand new book called Famous Father Girl, a memoir of growing up Bernstein. You had mentioned your father and his TV shows and introducing audiences to music and to composers, and I have to say, I just remember this so well. This was 1966. It was a CBS special called Inside Pop, The Rock Revolution. And your dad introduced us to Janis Ian and this song that she wrote called Society's Child. Let me just play about a little more than a minute of that, and then we'll talk about
Great.
It.
Society's Child contains many of the musical joys we've talked about, and some we haven't, like fascinating sounds, both natural and electronic, like a strange use of harpsichord and that cool, nasty electric organ. There are astonishing key changes and even tempo changes, ambiguous cadences, unequal phrase lengths, the works. And we're even luckier to have Janis Ian herself here to sing it for us. Listen hard to Society's Child. Thank you.
Again, a clip from this 1966 CBS special. She was singing about interracial romance, which in the 1960s was still considered a taboo. What did your father hear and see in Janice Ian?
Well, this was the thing about my dad. He was so ahead of his time, really, about a lot of issues. And he spent his entire life doing everything he could to make the world a better place. You know, he would lend his name to organizations, he would give money, he would do benefit concerts, whatever he could do in the world to try and you know, bring social justice or peace or, you know, whatever the issue was. This is why by the time he got to see his FBI file in the 1980s, he discovered it was 800 pages long.
Wow.
Because he'd been irritating J. Edgar Hoover for decades. So he was really struck by this song of Janice Ian's because she too was kind of ahead of her time in getting the big picture about what race meant in the United States and how it was the kind of tragic flaw that ran through our entire history. And so I think the two of them made a good match on that show about pop music. You know, this was another way that my father was demonstrating that another genre of music had as much value as the music that he was more known for performing and composing.
You know, he had a beautiful speaking voice. You can hear that. You can hear that in that clip.
You know, it's funny you mention that because in listening to it right now with these headphones on my head, I was noticing that he sounded a little bit what we used to call in my family, under the nose, which meant that we were having a sinus problem.
Oh.
And I could hear that, you know, that his voice was rattling around in his sinuses. But yes, he did have a good speaking voice.
Certainly did. I wonder, too, whether he, I don't want to make too much of this song because he introduced a lot of people to a lot of different musicians and songs as well, but whether he identified with being, if not a misfit, an outsider, a rebel, someone who didn't fit the kind of conventional view of society.
Well, I think he did come up against conventional views in all sorts of ways in the course of his life. And so he was very welcoming to those who, like him, felt themselves to be either outsiders or iconoclasts.
He was gay. And he was married, and he had children. And you write about this. You write about your parents' marriage and the sort of the complexities of relationships, obviously. And you also write about being a young person at Tanglewood and hearing rumors about your father and going to try to find out from your parents, was this true, was this not? What did this part of your life, what did that mean to you?
Well, this was a very difficult moment for me. I had just graduated from high school, so I was pretty young, and this was my first job out of high school, summer job at Tanglewood being a guide. And this is where I started hearing these rumors about my father's wild youth up there at Tanglewood when he was a student there. And he was still going up to Tanglewood every summer now as a teacher and conductor. So that summer, I saw him up there, you know, it being the superstar that he was, and also hearing these rumors about his past. And this was all a lot for me to process as a 17-year-old. And as a 17-year-old, you're having trouble with your parents anyway. So I mentioned all of this in a letter to my dad. And my mother was the one who invited me home for the weekend when I had a day off just to have dinner and hang out. And then after dinner, my father took me for a little walk and talked to me about these rumors that I had told him about hearing. And he actually denied the rumors and said that, well, there were a lot of people in the world who were jealous of his success and they would make up stories. And sometimes they even tried to blackmail him. And a lot of what he told me was true. But the part that wasn't so true was that the rumors were untrue. So it was very confusing for me because eventually I came to understand that there was some substance to these rumors that I had heard, and I just had to piece it all together little by little on my own over the course of my college years.
Do you think he was protecting you, protecting himself, protecting...
My theory is that he was actually protecting my mother. My mother knew he was gay from the beginning. They went into their marriage with their eyes wide open and understood that what they were trying to do was going to be a challenge, but they really genuinely loved each other. And my siblings and I never doubted that for a second. It was completely evident, not just to us, but to the whole family and their friends and everyone who knew them, that they genuinely adored each other. So it was tricky, you know? But I think that whatever their arrangement was, it involved my father not bringing that side of his life into our family universe. And so when this little crack happened in the shape of their lives at home, I think my mother may have said, "Why don't you try and find a way to make everything continue as it was?" That's my theory. I have no way of knowing what really went down between them.
Well, you do include a letter, actually, that your mother wrote to your dad. I think it was right before they got married, or they were very early married. She said to him, "You are a homosexual and may never change. I'm willing to accept you as you are without being a martyr and sacrificing myself on the LB altar." LB meaning, of course, Leonard Bernstein.
Right.
Altar. Those two sentences say so much.
Yes, they do. And we were astonished to read this letter quite recently because it had been sealed by my father's manager, Harry Kraut. And then we unsealed it, my brother and sister and I, just maybe in the last, over the last 10 years at some point. And then we gave it and various other unsealed documents to the Library of Congress to join the rest of the archives. And my general feeling about sensitive subjects like this is that if you try to suppress them, they're just going to find a way to come back around and bite you in the butt. That's always my feeling about these things. And I think it's better to be honest and to just put it out there in the context of love and caring. And then this is what I attempt to do in my book, is to talk about these issues in the context of how we basically all loved each other and found a way to get through it.
Well, that's why I think it's so important. And I think to think that relationships and families are not complicated, that people don't have secrets or demons and can still care for each other. And it was clear, I mean, your mother died in her 50s, and it seems your dad, you know, wanted to nurture her and take care of her.
Well, he tried as best he could in this terrible last year of her life where she was very sick with cancer. And it was just a tough patch there, because there was a moment when my father left my mother for this man in 1976. And he couldn't really sustain that life. So he came back to my mother in 1977, and the family was so relieved, but my mother was coughing a lot. And then 1 year after that, she was dead. Wow. So that was three tough years in a row, actually.
You describe her as the family policeman and Lenny stabilizer, your mom.
She was definitely a Lenny stabilizer, which was not the world's most wonderful job, I can assure you. But she did give us this incredibly stable, gracious, warm, lovely home environment to grow up in. And it was great for my dad because he was such a all-over-the-place kind of a guy. And he really thrived by having this home life that really had a reliable shape and reliable warmth. And that was great for him. So after our mother died, it was really tough for him not to have that anymore. He kind of flew off the handle in many ways.
Well, you also write about the fact that there were that your mom developed fears. I mean, that I don't know if there were things that were happening inside the relationship that made her fearful. But you have a section here where you write about sort of realizing that she was afraid of something or kind of withdrew from the world.
I don't know why she was that way, but We understood from a fairly early age that there were things that she was afraid of.
Yeah.
She was afraid of airplanes, fear of flying, which, you know, Lord knows she was not the only one to have that one. My brother has it very badly himself. And she had performance anxiety as an actress and as a pianist. And so we saw that she had these fears and that she was vulnerable. She was a little bit fragile. And we always had that sense. And then when she got sick early and died early, that all seemed of a piece with the fact that she was this very fragile person.
Who held the family together, seems in many ways.
That's right. And yet she held the family together in this very strong way.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, talking with Jamie Bernstein today on Radio Times. Her new memoir is titled Famous Father Girl, a memoir of growing up Bernstein and her father, of course, Leonard Bernstein. And we are talking about what it was to grow up in this family and, of course, to be surrounded by music as well. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. And I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. So how much did you want to be a musician yourself? I mean, in certain ways, you did.
I did eventually, but it was always, I was dragging my feet the whole time. As a kid, I took piano lessons, as did my brother and sister, and we all kind of hated our piano lessons, and we never practiced. We had bad attitudes. And it wasn't until I quit my piano lessons that I started playing the piano for fun and actually started writing songs, which I also did on the guitar, which I taught myself to play. And it was through the guitar that I really found a way to make music my own. And I even wound up pursuing a career for a while as a singer-songwriter, and I actually got all the way to getting a record deal, and I made the record with Island Records. And then the Island Records didn't like the way the recording came out, and they decided not to release it. So it was just a horrible disappointment. And at that point, I'd just gotten married, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to move on. But the truth was that the whole time I was pursuing music, I was kind of in agony about it. I was so self-conscious and so unself-confident and always making the odious comparisons and really driving myself crazy. So it wasn't until I set aside music that I started feeling like a like an entire functioning human being.
Was your dad supportive of this? I mean, he was critical of your piano playing, as I recall.
Well, he was supportive. He was very supportive, but he was also so compulsively competitive, even unconsciously competitive, that kind of undercut his support in a way.
You even went to L.A. for a while, and I'm curious about the songs that you wrote. What did you write about?
Oh, I wrote about all kinds of things. You know, I wrote love songs. I wrote songs about world events. I wrote, you know, the full
Topical.
Gamut. But I must say that I had a special fondness for writing songs to my dad, mostly to tease him, like roasting songs. And I did this for years, and so that actually turned out to be the most satisfying and amusing way to write songs, because that way I knew my father would give me his undivided support for those songs, and it was a very satisfying experience.
In fact, you include some of the lyrics in here. It seems like the family wrote lots of songs, many of them, as you say, of the roasting variety.
Yeah, well, it was sort of our family job to roast our dad all the time, not just as his kids, but also his siblings were, you know, lifelong roasters of their older brother. It was just our way to bring him back down to earth, because he was so venerated and celebrated in all that he did around the world. So when he came home, we had to remind him that he was a human being like the rest of us.
He grew up in Massachusetts, and his father, Sam, seemed as if he was a rather strict, austere, perhaps constrained kind of person. I don't know if that's the kind of family your dad grew up in.
He was. Well, he had the classic immigrant success story. He came to the United States to escape the pogroms in Russia, Ukraine, Poland area. He was 17 years old. He arrived without a coin in his pocket.
Wow.
And somehow managed to get jobs and find distant cousins and worked his way up until he owned his own hair and beauty supply business in Boston. It was an incredible success story. And the crowning element of that success story was that he was going to be able to hand the Samuel J. Bernstein Hair Company to his eldest son, Leonard, to run. But, of course, the problem was that his eldest son, Leonard, wanted to be a musician.
Yeah.
And it was a big problem for their relationship because back in the old country, being a musician was a klezmer who was basically this homeless guy who trudged from village to village with his beat-up fiddle and would play at the wedding and get a few coins and then be sent off to the next village. And, you know, you call this a living? So, of course, Sam didn't want to encourage his son to be a musician because that didn't sound like a good way to make a living. And anyway, there was this fabulous, thriving business. Why wouldn't he want to run that?
We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation with Jamie Bernstein. And again, talking about her dad, her life with her dad. This is Three Dances episodes from the musical On the Town, performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Carl Davis. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Again, talking with Jamie Bernstein about her book, Famous Father Girl, a memoir of growing up, Bernstein. And she is speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Free Library of Philadelphia. She is a writer. She's a concert narrator, a filmmaker. And this year is the 100th anniversary of her father. Leonard Bernstein would have turned 100 this year. There are concerts all over the world to commemorate his extraordinary talents and gifts. Joining us now is Jonathan Coopersmith, and he's a conductor. He's also chair of musical studies at the Curtis Institute of Music. He lectures on music history and theory in the Philadelphia region. And I should add that Leonard Bernstein attended Curtis for 2 years, and we want to get the Curtis story in here. Jonathan Coopersmith, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Jamie, one of the things that you say about your father is he had this kind of extravagant affection for everyone. And Jonathan, you have a story about meeting Leonard Bernstein. Tell us that story.
Sure. It was the fall of 1988, I think, if memory serves. So it was obviously toward the end of his life. I was 19 and a composition and theory student at the University of Pennsylvania. And at Penn, we invited Stephen Sondheim to speak to the music department, to the drama department, and being an ambitious student, I made sure I sat next to him when we took him out to lunch. And being young and bold, I can't believe I did this, but I asked him for his contact information, for an address, for a number. I was doing a number of shows at Penn and writing a show, and I thought it would be great to get his advice. So I asked if I could write him a letter. He said, of course. And then in the next breath, I said, well, I know you worked with Leonard Bernstein. Do you mind giving me his contact information, too? So I wrote him a letter, and I got a nice letter back from his manager, who invited me to a New York Philharmonic rehearsal. And
wow.
At the break, I was, of course, sitting in the audience. But at the break, I went down and I stood in the wings, and this line had formed. I guess this was a tradition of people, of guests, of people who wanted to see him. He was signing pictures and autographs and things. And he had some assistants who were handling the line. But I, rather than get in the line, I just stood off into the wings. If you've seen the old Coke commercial from the late 70s with Mean Joe Green, he sort of looked over at me in the wings and said, hey, kid, what are you doing here? You know, come over here. So I stood next to him. And he said, stick with me. This will be a great educational experience. So he had an interview to do in his dressing room also before, I guess, the rehearsal resumed. He asked me to join him for the interview, and I said I didn't know what to say. I declined, but he took me up there anyway. He sent me out a drink as well from his dressing room during the interview. He said, "Here, Meister wants you to have a drink." He asked me to stay afterwards. We talked, and then he said, "Come back to my house. Let's keep talking. We'll have dinner." So I had the limo ride back to the house, and we had a great conversation. He gave me a lot of great advice. He asked me to play for him the pieces I was working on. It was just that afternoon and evening certainly was a big influence on me, a night I'll never forget. And of course, I went on to write more letters back and forth with him. I saw him a few more times, but of course, it was less than two more years after that he passed away.
Oh, wow. Does that sound like your dad, Jamie Bernstein?
It sure does.
I'm sure mine is one of many stories like that.
It is, but your story, you had a lot more time than most people. And good for you. It sounds like you had an amazing experience.
It was a full day's worth. And for a 19-year-old college student, it doesn't get any better than that. It's a music student. We talked a lot about conducting, about composing, so many different his life and opportunities. I had so many questions for him. So, again, it was an afternoon and evening I'll never forget.
Jamie, did your father talk about his time at Curtis at all?
He talked about it some, not so much to me personally, but I know that he had a very tough couple of years while he was at Curtis, actually. I think he was lonely, and Philadelphia was not the hoppin' place it is now.
No.
Back then. It was really kind of a sleepy town, and, you know, Rittenhouse Square was very stuffy, and I think he felt like a fish out of water. And But Lucas Foss said something really funny about my father at Curtis. They were the composer, conductor Lucas Foss was at Curtis at the same time as my dad. That's where they met and were friends for life. And Lucas said, you know, Lenny was depressed, but he had such an extravagant way of being depressed that I never really worried about him. He was going to be fine.
You knew he was depressed, right? No sense of hiding that. Yeah. We haven't really talked about his music, but let me put this to you, Jonathan, about broadly speaking, if you were, you know, taking all his music together, what do you hear? I mean, what do you hear Leonard Bernstein doing?
Well, he had an extraordinary gift for melody, and I think that's evident in the types of pieces that he wrote, lots of choral works, and of course he's so well known for popular pieces and his Broadway music, he just could not write the atonal, post-tonal music that so many people were writing. In my conversation with him and interviews I've read, he just had, I don't think he quite understood the lack of melody, the lack of appeal. And there's a great interview, actually, that's up on the Curtis website, the archives, where he's speaking with Aaron Copland, and I think there are a few others there as well. But they're talking about what it means to write American music. Of course, he was the youngest of the people talking around the piano, and it was an incredible interview because they were not only talking but they were sitting around a piano and they were playing each other's music. So Aaron Copland and Leonard Bernstein, it's a full 1 hour interview.
Oh, wow.
So it's the idea of trying to write American music was not something that they were necessarily after, but of course that's what ended up happening. And so he had his musical influences, and I think his gift for melody led him to write what we know to be an American theater, very popular appeal, popular sound.
How about for you, Jamie?
And mind you, he was perfectly capable of writing 12-tone, atonal music,
that's
and sometimes
true.
He did. Yes. He just didn't want to feel restricted to having to write that kind of music exclusively, which was what you had to do in those days if you wanted to be a so-called serious composer that was, got the stamp of approval from the halls of academe, like the Curtis Institute, for example.
Right.
But, he liked to mix it up. He was always breaking down those walls between the genres, you know.
In fact, you end your book, Jamie, about the deepest essence of his work is his music, as you say. There he is in all his tenderness, his raunchiness, his intellectual panache, his agonizing over God, his despair over humanity, his cautious but dogged hope that we're all getting somewhere. When we listen to that music, it's the next best thing to getting a hug from Daddy himself, which is beautiful.
Oh, thanks. Well, that is how I feel about his music.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, we use the word American, and yet it feels so urban and so American. Jonathan, before we say goodbye to you, can you just weigh in on that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. There was an appeal that he had, and again, I'll go back to what I said earlier. Just his gift for being able to connect to people, with melody, with rhythm, and as far as I know, again, he wasn't trying to create an American sound. I think he was writing what sounded good to him. And then, of course, had such a wide appeal to so many. So I think we look at his music today and think that he's one of a handful of composers that defined an American sound. But I think you're absolutely right. The urban appeal, the rhythms that he used over and over again, I think give it that flavor. He's so widely accepted to be one of the great American composers as well.
And isn't it telling, by the way, that all these composers that we consider American and who gave us the sound of American music, Aaron Copland, George Gershwin, Leonard Bernstein, all sons of immigrants who came from Eastern Europe.
Exactly, and lots of dance rhythms that they used from that, from where they came from. So it was different types of dance rhythms that give it that feel that we now associate with an American sound.
Yeah, so interesting. Jonathan Cooper-Smith, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Great, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's a conductor chair of musical studies at the Curtis Institute of Music. Leonard Bernstein attended Curtis for 2 years here in Philadelphia. Continuing our conversation with Jamie Bernstein, author of Famous Father Girl, a memoir of growing up Bernstein. He was such an exuberant conductor.
Yes, he was.
I mean, I think there are times he almost fell off the podium.
He did once in Houston. He clambered back up, but from the floor he told the orchestra, "Weiter, weiter, like keep going." It was the Vienna Philharmonic. He just told him, and then he got back up and
kept going.
He didn't drop a beat, but
did they?
No, they kept a-going. I was very surprised when I finally saw Herbert von Karajan conduct, which didn't happen until I was, in my very early 20s. And Karajan, who's one of the great maestros of the world, barely moved and conducted mostly with his eyes closed, and yet he got these incredible results out of his orchestras. And that was the first moment when I thought, oh, you mean you don't actually have to jump around and express the music with your body the way my dad did? And it turns out that there are different ways of conducting, different styles. And my father's style just happened to be this very physical style where he really used his body to convey his information to the musicians. And it just had this very nice byproduct for the audience behind him that by watching him moving, you would actually learn a lot about the music, but it wasn't why he did it. And many people misunderstood this, that they thought he was jumping around for their benefit in the audience. But actually, any musician in the orchestra that he conducted would tell you that everything he did with his body was a direct communication to the players.
Let me read some comments. A tweet from Zach. Jamie, have you seen your father, Leonard, on Omnibus explaining the blues? A friend of mine showed me a few years ago, and I still think about it. He likens the blues to Shakespeare's prose. It's quite awesome. Did he have other observations like that in music or life?
Oh, he never stopped with the observations of all kinds, not just musical, but about everything. He was a compulsive teacher. Mm-hmm. That's why he was so great on television talking about music. But everything he did in life, whether he was, telling us about the blues or telling us a really good Jewish joke or reciting Lewis Carroll or whatever it was all the same essential impulse of kind of grabbing you by the sleeve and saying, listen to this. I have to share this with you because I'm so excited about it. And so his love of learning was instantly translated into a love of teaching. It was all one cycle of communication to him.
a tweet from Cindy who says, in college choir years ago, we had the challenge and privilege to perform Bernstein's Chichester Psalms. What an amazing piece of music. One of my most favorite choral experiences.
Oh, Chichester Psalms is the greatest. And it's very accessible. It's quite tricky in ways for choruses, but a lot of young people discover my dad's music through Chichester Psalms when they have a high school or college chorus that performs it. And just this year, I talked to high school students who learned Chichester Psalms and really got immersed in it. And after the performance, this is in Tucson, Arizona, they came up to me for hugs and selfies.
Yeah.
And they all said, oh, we just love this music so much. We were obsessed with it. We just think it's the greatest thing in the world. And I thought, this is a fantastic way for young people to learn who Leonard Bernstein was, because these days they might not know so much anymore.
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We have an email from Zachary. I recently saw Leonard Bernstein's set of Talmud at an auction. Did he ever use it? What was his relationship with Judaism?
Oh, gosh. I wonder if that's the set of the Talmud that he inherited from his father, Sam, because I remember seeing those ancient bindings falling apart in the lower bookshelf in our library. So maybe it's them. My father himself had a very intense and kind of private relationship with his religion, which he expressed very much through his music. Mm. But he wasn't a regular attender of synagogue on Saturdays. He had his own way of being Jewish. But his father, Sam, was a Talmudic scholar. And so that was where the real intensity of religion came from.
His music is being performed this year all over the world. Are you just, you know, running from one city to the next?
I cannot even tell you how crazy it is. Thank God I have two siblings, because my brother and sister and I are constantly trifurcating and going literally all over the world to participate in the celebration at our database at the Bernstein office. So far, we have now surpassed 3,300 centennial-related events worldwide. So you get the picture?
I got the picture. Jamie Bernstein, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been very fun.
Fun for us as well. And her book is Famous Father Girl, a memoir of growing up Bernstein. And this is Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, performing his symphonic suite from the 1954 film On the Waterfront, the film, of course, starring Marlon Brando, directed by Ilya Kazan. Thanks for joining us.